F4.
Number 25A.
We come now to the subject of Christianity as Christianity, where really the accent now is on Christianity itself. Christianity is, as we have seen, at the focal point of universe, including man. So we have always Word as the Father, then Christ as the Son, and then the universe or mankind as Christianity, the outcome of that Christ idea. So we have here the epitome that in the oneness with the Word and the Christ, the world, that's Christianity, is overcome. Now this is a big subject because we all suffer under the universe, we live in this universe, we have a feeling that somehow we are thrown into the universe as it exists today, and we have to see how we swim in that universe and get dry land under our feet and find a really a secure standpoint in it. So it is something that will help us to solve this attitude. Again, we can see it when we go through the text that he takes up four different aspects in order to show how we can see that the world is overcome, what we have to do, what we have to entertain in our consciousness so that we are not living in an old universe and with our heart somehow try to be to adore a spiritual God and the Christ, but yet still have next to that a material universe. It starts out with chapter 16, 5. By the way, oh no, goes too far. here it says, "But now I go my way to him that sent me." He repeats that sentence again, "I go my way to him that sent me." Constantly his admonition, "I go to the Father. That's my safety. That's where I'm safe. From there I go out. And none of you asketh me, whither goest thou?" Because when he has said before, you remember that he said that he goes to the Father, and the way ye know, that Thomas didn't know the way he know and didn't know where he was would be going. But now, "No one asketh me, whither goest thou?" So they have already established now the very certainty that in every situation that we find in the world, where we have to deal with the world, that we are not going to the world in order to deal with it, but that we are going to our origin, to the Father, to God, to the Word. So at this point it is established, so that they are not even asking anymore. They know now, and we should know now by now, that there is no any other place to go. We can't go anywhere else but to our divine principle. And so Mrs. Eddy came and said that even clearer and said, well, from the divine principle comes an infinite idea, so we know there is only one cause and one effect, so we go always to that divine principle. But he said to the disciples, "But because of this saying, sorrow has filled your heart." Sorrow has filled your heart because he could see that the disciples still were leaning on him as a person. And you can easily think how a situation is when you had such a terrific caliber as Jesus was, and leading them the way of understanding, and then suddenly feel that he says, "Now I go and leave you behind, I go to the Father." How they must have felt. They must have felt really at loss. They must have felt alone, without a leader, without a guide, without an inspirator, without a visionary. And so one can understand that sorrow filled their heart. Taking away people always gives us sorrow, though we know that there is only one way to go, namely to the Father, that there is only one reality, namely the Father. So he says, This is so important. In 7, it is expedient, as if he would say, this is necessary. This is absolutely necessary what I do. It is expedient for you that I go away. In other words, he said, this will help you. It will for your progress if I go away. For if I go not away, the Comforter will not come unto you. So he could see that the Comforter would be a much higher idea that would come into the world than as Jesus, as a person would be. And so he said, if I don't go out of the way, I make no room for something higher to come in into your consciousness, namely the Comforter, namely the impersonal Christ, the impersonal Christ signs, or according to Mr. Zeddy, really the divine signs, cannot come unto you. But if I depart, I will send him unto you. This is a very important point. I remember way back when John Dolly was giving his terrific summer school in Oxford in 1949, where he did take those four Gospels, and we felt this is really the climax of revelation. It was so full, you know. For 2 consecutive weeks he was giving those 4 Gospels, not only one. So it was just a terrific stream of life, of the newness of life, and a terrific vision of us, what was lying in front of us. That at that point he said right afterwards to me, he said, no, he said it actually to the whole class. He said, now I would like to go away from London. I would like to be left alone. And perhaps here and there come back to London, perhaps for a summer school or so, but I would like to go to a very quiet, isolated place where I can be alone with God, where I can think with God, where I can be really thinking and doing the things that are necessary. While in London, he was naturally constantly taken in by all the administrative and organizational activities that went on around him, with the Foundational Book Company, with giving weekly talks and so on and so on. So he had that feeling too, and he went actually away, but only for a short time. He went down to the east, to the south coast, only for a few months, and then he said, I think it's better I go. The situation will look better if I'm no more here. And so he wanted to go. And actually for us who were there felt the same way as those disciples felt, that they were sorrowful, that sorrow filled their heart. It was a situation which we couldn't quite understand at that time, because we were expecting so much to come forth further from his consciousness, and now suddenly to be cut off of that stream of life, that newness of life, that well of life, of the living waters. And we were just greenhorns at that time in regard to science. We really felt that sense of sorrow, or let's say most felt it, and it was not easy for most of the students. And I always remember when I got that news, when Peggy wrote a letter and saying that John Dolly went on and said, I'm sorry to write this letter. I was sitting in my office and was reading that letter, and actually one really felt that sense, now, who is going to lead us on? Who is going to give us new inspiration? Now we are left alone. What can we do now? And somehow the thought came to me while I was reading it, was surprised. I didn't know about that the situation would be as it was. I felt, yes, we have so much that we have not digested of John Stolle's work, that I think it's a good thing that we are now forced to go back to what he has been teaching over the last 10, 15 years and make it our own. And that was the comfort and the comforter. And it turned out, really, that naturally it was good that everybody had to ask himself, where am I now? Do I depend on John Dolly, or do I depend on his teaching? Am I left alone personally, or have I found, or am I going to find the teaching so that I'm not left alone? So everyone had to really begin to go to the books and to his teaching and make it their own. That was a comfort. And he could see that if he would stay around us too long, that we would just try to run after him and run after him. The inspiration just came so quickly from year to year that we nearly came out of breath by running after him and just couldn't really keep up with him. And so we only take in what by reading what he says, but not in the spiritual sense. So we had to make it our own. So he made that terrific decision, which not everybody likes to do, to say, I go right out of the fullness of my life and out of the fullness of teaching, because I lay down my life for my friends. That's love. And my friends must learn to stand on their own legs, and must get their own understanding. And perhaps in a tiny, tiny little bit, that was the reason why 3 years ago I said, I'm not come back next year, I may not come back the second year, but somehow I will come back. And I said that to the whole field, also in Europe, and I think it was a very prosperous period, where the students were seeing they have a lot to make their own, to go back to the books and see what is actually to be learned, what is actually to be digested, to make it their own, instead of coming home and doing the chores after a summer school, and then comes Christmas, and it's anyway very busy, and then comes a holiday, a winter holiday, and then comes the announcement, very soon is the next summer school, prepare yourself for the next summer school, without having digested what has been given before. So I think from time to time this is a good thing to do, and that's what Jesus saw too. He said, the comforter cannot come unto you. That impersonal comforter, that comforter which is a book, which is a science, which is a system, that cannot come unto you as long as a person is always standing in your way. So that's what happened. So we see how spiritual history repeats itself, and Jesus gave us an example. What will happen when he said, the Comforter will come unto you? Then he says in verse 8, and when he is come, he will reprove the world of sin, second of righteousness, and third of judgment. So he says, that Comforter will do these three things. What did he mean by it? He says he will reprove the world of sin. In 9, because they believe not on me. You can see what he was saying. What is the sin we have seen? The sin is not to start out from principle, to start out from people, from us, from any, from phenomena. This is the sin. So he said, the Comforter will teach you that. The Comforter will teach you that there is only one principle that interprets itself to it, to the world as a system. And unless the person does not go out of the picture, we are not constantly forced to go back to the divine principle and start out from there. Then, of righteousness, he will judge the world of righteousness, because, and he gives the reason, because I go to my Father. He says that only true righteousness is the righteousness of God, not the righteousness of the old law, the Jewish law. That was righteousness. We know that Also, Paul starts out his great epistle of the Romans with that righteousness, that there is only one righteousness before God, and that's the righteousness of God, because he had to deal with the righteousness of the Pharisees, who said, only if you obey the law, the Pharisaical law, the Moses law, if you only obey that, then you are a righteous man. So he had to correct that. He could see that if we take away all personality, that then we have to go back to the one Father, because I go to my Father. He didn't go to the Talmudic law. Did you understand? Back to the Talmud, yes, to the Mosaic law. So again, he could see that we have to go back to the science of God, and not just to human dogmas, to religious dogma, ecclesiastical hierarchies, and so on. These are no authority for us. We have to go to the science of that one principle. And third, he said that he has come to reprove the world of judgment, and says what that means. He said, because the prince of this world is judged. What does that mean? Now we have for the third time the prince of this world. And every time when you look at it, you see that he deals with that prince of this world in a different way. And every time he deals with it in a little bit a higher way. The first time he was talking about the prince of this world, it was that he was cast out. So he came and he was cast out, as if he would exist. He was thrown out, was cast out. The second time, in the part B, it is said that the prince of this world cometh and finds nothing in me. He has no foothold in me. He has nothing in me to settle down. He has no place within me. You cannot go against the well of life. That well of life has only a one-way road, namely to go out, and you cannot swim against the stream. So they come and find nothing in me. He finds in me no place where he could, so to say, get in and do his tricks. So he finds nothing in me, but he still cometh, as if he were something. And now the third time, he talks about the prince of this world, that he is now judged. That he is now judged means that he is seen to be nothing. That's now the last time that the prince of this world cometh. He is now seen to be nothing. So in Christianity, where we have the realm of ideas, we cannot have any realm of illusions, any realm of mortal mind. So he is judged as nothing, and so brought back to the nothingness of nothing. So in this way, the Christ idea really introduces that very new paradigm of the Comforter. See, that has all to do with the Comforter. The Comforter does these three things. Huh? The Comforter, which is divine science, takes care, so to say, of sin, of human righteousness or ecclesiastical righteousness, and of judgment. Divine science can make nothing out of animal magnetism. Only when we go out from divine science, we really are making nothing of animal magnetism, because as long as we are going out from Christian science, we fight animal magnetism. We are the Michael state of consciousness, and we fight against animal magnetism and say within our consciousness, well, animal magnetism has no power, it has no intelligence, it has no origin, it has no substance, it has no channels with which to reach, he has no unfoldment, he cannot do anything, he cannot bear fruit. We go on through all the seven synonymous terms and handle it from the point of view of soul and say animal magnetism has no voice, cannot speak, cannot be listened to. Animal magnetism is sinful, therefore we must see the sinlessness of being, And so we go to principle and begin to see that animal magnetism cannot operate, that it cannot govern us, that he is not the government of us, that animal magnetism has no system through which to work, that it has really nothing as no spiritual power with which to work. And so we rob step by step animal magnetism of its nature. We see animal magnetism from the point of view of life as being mortal, a mortal concept, that it always drags us down, that it cannot exalt us, that animal magnetism therefore is not a source of supply, nor can it support us, nor maintain us. So we handle it from that point, or from the point of view of truth, see, animal magnetism is not conscious of itself, therefore cannot act consciously, because truth is the only consciousness, and we disrobe animal magnetism of its claim for sickness, for sin, and for death. We rob it of everything and see that it has no consciousness. Or we go to love and handle it from the point of view of love and can see that animal magnetism has no plan according to which it operates, that it cannot fulfill its aim and its purpose, that it cannot attain an aim. And so we disrobe animal magnetism, say, from the point of view of love. Well, the more you think about it and handle it through the ideas of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, the more you handle animal magnetism, because as if it were something, see. So you cast it out and say, no, actually it has no power, no substance, no identity, no spiritual power, no life, no consciousness, no fulfillment, and you cast out animal magnetism. It's casting out. But at one point we reach a higher consciousness, that of when the prince of this world comes and findeth nothing in me. It is that consciousness where we have filled our consciousness positively with all the ideas of mind and of spirit and soul and principle, life, truth and love, that there is no loophole through which animal magnetism could enter at all. And so we feel that as long as we are working in absolute Christian science, where we constantly are aware of how principle expresses itself only in ideas and always in ideas, that principle operates constantly as a self-organizing principle, therefore always taking care of every situation and being, so to say, the mistake-friendly, regulating everything, controlling everything, correcting everything, self-correcting. We feel then animal magnetism can come in, can come to us and finds no door to enter, because our consciousness is full of ideas. Then comes the higher sense of divine science, where you can see that animal magnetism, as it is shown here, is judged. It does not raise its voice. Because it is judged and is guilty and is done away, it not even raises his voice. That's the point where we are no more afraid of animal magnetism, where we no more believe that there is such a thing as animal magnetism to be handled. That's naturally a higher state of consciousness. So animal magnetism is touched. It's brought right back to nothing, and thou art nothing and nothing. It doesn't exist. Where we have no more a consciousness of having to deal with the world, with the prince of this world. Yes, that's what he was first showing, that really from the point of view of the word, that the comforter judges the prince of this world. You can see that when once we reach divine science, which Mrs. Eddy calls divine science with a capital D, that lifts us out of all those, out of the realm of what she calls, she discovered Christian science, and that she wrote the textbook on Christian science. She never said she wrote the textbook on divine science with a capital D. She knew that the idea will evolve, and that really the comforter, or really the paraclete, the the helper, the advocate that will come is of a much higher altitude. That altitude of divine science with a capital D, which is dealing only with principle knowing itself, with principle being aware of its own self. And therefore, there is no argument of animal magnetism at all. There is the consciousness where, which is so full of the divine principle, knowing only itself, always falling back on itself, being conscious of itself, seeing only itself, being aware only of itself, reflecting only always on itself, always saying, where the I am says, what is my I amness? Where the I am says, I am the I am, what is that I am? What am I? It's not that sense of seeing that there is a universe of ideas. It's a much higher sense, because then that center and circumference falls away, and there is just the one that is at work, the infinite one that is at work. A little bit of it we will get when we do the fourth part of this gospel.